99.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. You can write us, Taylor, at CIUT.FM, and check us out, Taylor-Report.com. And there's two great upheavals going on, really important ones. In Chicago, there is a protest against NATO, which is holding meetings. The leaders of NATO are holding a meeting in Chicago, and then finally they're starting to see the American public turn out in great, great numbers. And, of course, Chicago is the place to do it. It's one of the great industrial cities. It's sort of the biceps, literally and figuratively, of America. And I understand, Phil Connors here, I understand that there are veterans who are throwing their medals or giving their medals back.
Giving the medals back and giving speeches why and saying that they were lied to, that they were fighting for things that were not issues in fact.
Well, you know, they're the real heroes. Yes.
Those are heroes.
Let's see if they... I can't wait for one of our Toronto Star reporters to adopt one of those guys. I'm adopting the Sergeant So-and-so who gave his medals back because I think I'm going to drop this from my column. Yeah, good. Good for them. And Montreal, there is a student movement which is vast, quickly turning into something like a social movement. According to one of the ministers, Mr. Charest, it is an insurrection in a sense. It's amusing to watch a government lose its mind in front of the world and all the major commentators here in Canada slowly melting down because they don't know. As Bob Dylan says, something's going on and you don't understand, do you, Mr. Jones?
Yeah, well, you know, the Globe and Mail columnist Margaret Wente wrote a column, which I didn't read. I just read the headline.
Well, that's the way to do it.
She said, the students in Quebec are the Greeks of Canada. And I thought, well, you know what? You're right, Margaret, not in the way you intended. But
well, there's a big Greek community, which is part of this, in Montreal, and one of the defining communities. Did you say Margaret went?
Yeah.
You know, we've raised that question many times. Isn't it time that Margaret went? And we think we know the answer. We will be talking, I should say. Our guests are going to be Yves Engler, who is going to be speaking to us from... Montreal. He's been participating in these demonstrations. And Yves Engler, by the way, is the author of a great book, Lester Pearson's Peacemaking, The Truth May Hurt. We've talked to him on this program. He has a site, Yves Engler, Yves Engler.com. I recommend you go to that site. Later in the show, we're going to talk to Steve Gowans, who writes very, very excellent commentary. I'd say a straight, flat-out socialist commentary on international affairs. And we're going to talk to him about NATO and whether NATO is coming into being or passing out of being or what the heck. And also, what is it up to in Europe with a so-called missile shield, which is advancing in... Eastern Europe, and the language around that is actually very worrying, which makes us very glad that there are people in Chicago challenging NATO, because what we understand from Rick Rosoff and others is that there's a serious challenge coming back now from Russia to NATO's aggressive conduct, which they've had a sort of a hiatus here, a period where NATO... felt it could sort of throw its weight around anywhere, anytime, and damn the torpedoes. But now the Russians mentioned they have some torpedoes, and they're not too impressed. Often dangerous situations come up in a matter of 24, 48 hours. This could be one of those where somebody at the headquarters in Brussels makes a mistake in thinking that they can do any damn thing they please. We're witnessing in Syria... a situation where NATO and certainly the driving powers of NATO, Britain, the United States, and France, gave orders to the president, standing president of Syria, that he must step down. It's time that he went. They also called meetings where people said, like the Saudis said, we will pay the salaries of people to fight the Syrian army within Syria. The U.S. said we're going to give non-lethal aid, for example, night goggles to enable a sniper to kill Syrian soldiers. That's not non-lethal, it's lethal. And by the way, they haven't offered that aid to the Palestinians, who face a far more formidable opponent. And so the madness of this project of bringing down the Syrian government, bringing about regime change, was it was anticipated or treated as though it was just going to be an automatic, you know, like Libya. However, something has happened at the Security Council where the People's Republic of China and Russia vetoed this kind of behavior from the Western powers. And there was almost like a jam up at the door of all these big shots who had been talking about it. They're going to snap their fingers and bring down the government of Syria. And they all started talking a little bit out of the side of their mouths. The language has changed, and now we have the president of the Syrian National Council, who was embraced by Hillary Clinton and by Sarkozy. Oh, Mr. Sarkozy's missing. And then by the representative of Germany and of course, Mr. Cameron. Now the leader of the Syrian National Council has been the base under him is shaking, and he fell off. He's now out. Leads me to the observation that in Syria, maybe the United States and its NATO friends have cracked a molar. They may be bumping into something because it was all well and good if they thought they had Mr. President Assad isolated and therefore could mug him as they wished any time. Now they're having to ask each other, how much trouble do we want? And there are people in the neighborhood who would give them all the trouble they would like. And so this is an interesting moment for these super colonial powers who think that the world belongs to them and also to their royalist friends. The leaders, we're told, of the democratic movement of the Middle East are all absolute monarchs, every last one of them. And they're such idiots and pigs that, of course, they say, oh, I'm going to give money out of my pocket and hire killers in Syria, and I'm going to get away with that. And the Russians said, no, you're not going to get away with that. Yeah, that game is up. So it's a very interesting moment. And speaking of interesting moments, I think we actually have Eve Engler on the line. Are you there, Eve?
How's it going, Phil?
Not bad. I almost thought I heard a crowd behind you. You're in a pretty exciting district of the country.
Yes, I am. And there's about 1,000 people, maybe 700 people demonstrating right now, breaking the Bill 78 that the Sharia government tried to implement to ban all demonstrations of more than 50 people that aren't okayed by the police.
I want you to know, Eve, that I'm qualified to interview you because I'm wearing my red patch. Now, listen, do they have a big demonstration also scheduled tomorrow, the 22nd?
Yes, tomorrow's a big demonstration. Tomorrow will be certainly into the hundreds of thousands of people. It's the 100 days on strike, 100 days of mépris of the government maltreating the students. And at this point, it's not just about the students, of course. It's gone to the point where it's about just simple basic democratic rights of assembly, of association, of unions, for that matter. And so tomorrow it should be an absolutely gigantic demonstration.
Yeah. This is Eve Engler. He's the author of Lester Pearson, Peacemaking. It's Pearson's Peacemaking. The Truth May Hurt. And by the way, that book is people ought to have that as a handbook because you sort of studied these guys in terms of how they handle popular uprisings. All this stuff about you can't wear masks and you can't have 50 people. This is unprecedented basically since war measures, isn't it?
It is. And that's what a number of historians, Quebec historians, have said, and others have talked about this as the worst law since the War Measures Act. And basically, there's a whole series of things that the details that are sort of important. One, that the demonstration of more than 50 people needs to tell the police 8 hours in advance, tells the route, where it's going, and the police get to decide if it's legitimate or not, which was explicitly a response to the nighttime demonstrations that have been going on for 27 days, every night, the last 27 days, where the people would leave at 9 o'clock and go all across the city without a route and without a leader, for that matter, just because you know, just different groups decided at different moments to go in their own direction. It gives huge fines, this Bill 78, huge fines to those who participate in those illegal demonstrations, between $1,000 and $7,000 for individuals, and even bigger fines for student associations or labor unions that promote the demonstrations, up to $125,000 for the first promotion of a demonstration that's deemed illegal, and $250,000 for the second one. So that's if the main student federation, the CLASS, had to actually take their website down because they were just hosting all the announcements, all the different demonstrations taking place. There's been over 250 demonstrations over the past 4 months of strikes, and so they had to take their website down because if they posted a demonstration that happened to have someone who broke the law at it, under this new Bill 78, the cops could give them a fine of up to $125,000. So
amazing. I mean, by the way, aren't they really just training people into revolutionary behavior? Because what can you do if they take your rights away? You have to learn all kinds of techniques to express your own rights, the rights that they've stolen from you.
Without a doubt, what's happening here? What's happening here is that the Shaare government, from a very narrow electoral perspective, this is actually beneficial, and at least it appears to be in the short term from Shaare electorally. People see images of broken stuff on TV. The media distorts what's actually going on, and so basically, if people are given a choice between what is portrayed as the breakers in the downtown versus the government, people tend to choose the government. So Shaare playing a sort of tough hard line has a sort of electoral, and at least in the short term, has an electoral sort of positive from their standpoint, but from the standpoint of a longer term, from the standpoint of the Quebec business class, of the Quebec elite, this is catastrophic. There's tens and tens of thousands of young people who have been totally radicalized, politicized. You know, the use of Facebook and social media in terms of dissemination of information and your knowledge of political affairs, it's absolutely exploded.
Yeah.
And also it appears this Bill 78, it's not going to pass. People keep defying it. I was out there last three nights with the night demonstrations, where until 2:30 on Friday night, after I left at 2:30 in the morning, there were still about 700 people. I heard it went on until about 3:30 in the morning. Last night, after cops, in the most savage way, attacked us, hundreds and hundreds of riot cops attacked us. Still, it is about 3 hours after they attacked us about 20 minutes, 30 minutes into the demonstration, declared the demo illegal before it even left. And still at 1 in the morning, so 3-4 hours after they attacked us, we were still able to get back together, 300 or 400 people, to continue on a march, which again was, then attacked 5 minutes later by the riot squad. So the level of determination and commitment in the face of incredible repression is absolutely absolutely astonishing, and people all around Canada and the U.S. should be inspired by what's taking place here in Quebec.
Look at what some amazing Michael Moore down in Chicago said that this is the most inspiring thing he's seen. It is there's nothing comparable in North America in terms of widespread participation from all sectors of society. The Americans can't touch it. Nobody else, actually, in North America can touch it.
For sure. And people need to know the background of some of what's been going on. But the real core of this movement has been students in their individual CEGEPs and student associations at universities organizing into general assemblies, mass democratic decision-making process where everyone gets a vote, long discussions about the political consequences of choosing to go on strike. And just at the high point, it was up to over 300,000 students who were on strike, and now it's still the Bill 78 of sort of it ended the strike in the sense that all the semesters have been canceled. That's what the Shaare government did in response to the students striking, is actually canceled the semesters. They can't strike because the school's no longer on. But the basis of this movement is people, students in their associations, democratically voting to go on strike, and each week, so you'd vote to go on strike, and then you'd have another general assembly the next week, decide if the situation has changed, if there'd been a new offer from the government, and whether there should be, go back on strike. And week after week, students would vote to go on strike in a newer general assembly, and would discuss the options and discuss the downsides. And people have put their whole semesters on the line. Many people, many students, have paid the tuition already for this semester, which they will lose. And they just said, yes, we're going to lose, $1,300 in tuition for the semester, but we believe in this cause, and we're willing to, even at a strictly pocketbook standpoint, lose out. We believe in the long-term vision of accessible education, of the idea that education is a right, and it's not this model of corporatized universities where it's all about, certain type of job professions and not about knowledge and education as a larger sort of social and human development perspective.
Self-respect is kind of important.
It is, for sure. It is, for sure.
I hear that they have a slogan. They say, no to free mining, yes to free schooling.
Yes, exactly.
These are pretty bright guys.
Yeah, and it is important to know that people, in these demonstrations, people are making the connections with larger political issues. So there'll be slogans that talk about, exactly, like the Plan Nord, right? One of the issues that the Charest government's really pushing is the Plan Nord, about opening up all of northern Quebec to resource extraction and all of this sort of, this whole huge ecological questions with regards to that. And also, Charest has basically given the mining companies really cheap deal in terms of getting the natural resources. And so people are making the connections between those political decisions and the government saying we have no money to put into education.
Uh-huh.
Or conversely, at demonstrations, people are chanting, there's money in the pockets of the patronat, in the boss's pockets, right? So it's not a question of their hands up, oh, we can't do anything about it, we have to increase tuition, there's no money. But bringing in some of the class elements of these questions, and it's not that there's no money, it's a matter of there's choices, political choices, about giving tax cuts to the wealthy, giving tax cuts to the banks. And that's actually what class, the main student federations, their demand and with their proposal for paying they're calling for free education. They're not just calling for an end to the tuition increase, they're calling for actual free university post-secondary education. And they have a very elaborate proposal
about, they want a civilized country.
Exactly, civilized country, and they're just calling for a very modest increase in bank tax that would pay for the whole thing. So they have very elaborate sort of economic plans to finance these issues that are very class-based kind of perspective.
Now, you had a great book, which I remember Noam Chomsky wrote a preface to, and you must have been pleased that Noam Chomsky sent a message early on to the Quebec students, and he said it's not just that they want to put you in debt, but that they want that to turn into political control, because if you're in debt to them, they control you.
Exactly, exactly. I think that neoliberal vision of raising tuition as there's some economic imperatives. That's how it's portrayed. Oh, the state's got no money. We have to increase the individual's proportion of the costs. And that, there's an element of that, and that's an element of, it's a matter of we want to cut taxes for the wealthy, and so that the state has less money. But there's another element that's little discussed, which is the way that debt, putting students in debt, the way that controls them in terms of what jobs they might want to take or are able to take. So you end up law school with huge debt on your back. It's very unlikely that you're going to go into law practice that's more about, helping out, maybe, let's say, undocumented immigrants that are having difficulties. You're much more forced into, corporate law and other areas that pay well. And that has real consequences on individuals' lives, but also more generally on social movements and progressive politics in general.
Yeah, it's very it is really remarkable. And by the way, Chomsky points out that Norway, Chile, Mexico, they've taken these steps. I mean, I think it was in Mexico, he said they had a 6-month strike when they tried to take away the public education.
Exactly. I think it was even longer than 6 months. It was at the UNAM in Mexico City, that university of 200,000 people, and they were on strike for, I believe it was even over a year. That's what it takes, right? That's what it takes to push back against these neoliberal policies is it's not a matter of just going out to one demonstration. It's about going out and organizing day after day. And again, one of the things Chomsky points out in that little thing he sent out was that, if a country like Mexico can have the free education, it's just insanity that a country with all the wealth that Canada has can't
absolutely.
Also.
Absolutely. And this is Eve Engler, and he's the author of a great book, Lester Pearson's Peacemaking, The Truth May Hurt. It's a terrific book. Eve, this situation, about a year ago, we had this, of course, the Occupy Wall Street, and there was a kind of indulgence of it, but the media finally picked up on it. They talked about it. But I noticed that this year they were hoping that it had gone away. But, I mean, this is what's going on in Montreal is actually a reflection of all the basic things that started with the business about the 1% and the Wall Street. This is where Montreal is right in the center of that debate, isn't it?
I think for sure. And I think that lots of people who've been at the forefront of organizing this movement have been inspired clearly from Occupy Wall Street, but also from some of the movements taking place in Europe and even the Arab Spring. One of the students that came out with the March 22nd demo 2 months ago, which was somewhere over 100,000, some say as many as 300,000, but even the corporate media said over 100. It was Printemps Érable, right? So play on words in French of the Arab Spring, mm-hmm. and basically the Quebec Spring.
Yes.
The Maple Spring, similar to, so there's clearly people see this as part of something much bigger. And at this point, to understand it from the lens of tuition is mistaken. This has gotten into a much broader disenfranchisement with the state, really with the state of capitalism, with a state of an economic system that keeps giving more and more to a small few, with a logic of ecological destruction and a logic of just basically endless accumulation of profit, and I think that increasingly people on the street marching, you hear lots of slogans that are, one of the ones, anti-capitaliste, right? So we're anti-capitalist. There's a growing, complete distrust of the corporate media. One of the things you see happen in this situation is just how politicized the corporate media becomes. When you start becoming effective, those small spaces that used to exist in the dominant sort of institutions, those narrow up very quickly when you start having an effective social movement.
I was thinking that as these demonstrations get larger and more focused and clearer, the masks worn by the corporate media are coming off.
For sure. You should see the front pages of the Journal de Montréal the last 2 days, which is one of the dailies here in Montreal. It's just atrocious. The portrayal from someone who was actually part of the last 2 demonstrations to see what was actually happening on the ground, and then to see how it's reported. It's mind-boggling to see it. And also, just to see it across English Canada, to see the level of outrage and quite frankly, fear on the pages of the National Post, on the pages
Absolutely.
Of the Globe and Mail, yesterday's Globe and Mail that was supporting this Bill 78, which is, a very totalitarian bill. Even the Toronto Star, a week ago, I think it was now, some article, the lead editorial was, anarchy can't reign or something like that. that's as left-wing as it gets in terms of English-Canadian newspapers, and that's their perspective.
Yes. Well, one of their columnists, who ordinarily is known to be a reasonable person, said, it's too bad they don't put this energy into its proper channel of parliamentary elections. Now, by the way, you're an authority on all this. You've been demonstrating for years on peace and all the great issues. It's very insulting, isn't it, to have someone explain to you that democracy is only parliament?
Yeah, no. I mean, that's one of the things that's really interesting to see. That is how the condensation of it's the only legitimate form of participation is every 4 years you go to the ballot box and put something in. And that's basically, to some extent, how they're even justifying just listening to the public safety minister on Radio-Canada earlier today. That's how he's justifying this law. It's just simply it's a government that put this law into place. Therefore, it has to be respected. It's just as simple as that. You know, whether it's, you know, it's whether it's unconstitutional or whether it's just, you know, an affront to basic dignity. That's not, you know, part of the discussion. It's just we are a government that was put into place by the ballot box. Therefore, what we do is you know, right.
Yeah.
So.
And that's what they said when they hanged him at Haymarket and shot him at Kent State and hanged the Patriots. By the way, it's Patriot Day. You're very fortunate. How do you manage this? We have Victoria Day, and you got Patriots Day.
Yeah, and actually, I think the demonstration.
Isn't that against the law?
Yeah, I think the demonstration that I was on, or I'm just at the back of right now. I think it's actually meeting up with some sort of a rally that was taking was tied into the Patriots Day right now in old Montreal. So.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you one other. There's great slogans coming out of this. I read one that they're saying, Charest out. We'll get you a job up north. Is this part of this comment on his northern something or other?
Yes, exactly that. Well, part of it, what it was there was about 2 weeks ago, there was a conference that Charest spoke at about the Plan Nord, and students tried to disrupt the conference and were somewhat effective of doing so. It was quite a battle. That ended up taking place with the police in front of the conference. And actually, people want to watch any footage of that. They can see it at CUTV, the Concordia University Television, as they can also see this live streaming of the demonstration taking place right now on CUTV and the night demonstrations and going forward. And one of the things that Michael Moore linked to was CUTV on Saturday night, which is doing incredible grassroots sort of media work. But back to the question of your slogan, what Charest did at this conference at the Plan Nord is he made a joke, a dismissive joke about how we'll give the students a job way, way, way up north, right? Sort of, uh-huh. We'll get rid of them, basically, thing. And so what now, the play on that is that chanted regularly, the demonstration, is Charest, on va trouver un job au nord, right? So we'll get you a job up north as a response to his... not so funny joke.
Yeah, this is going to be a long, important battle. I think it's going to transform us all. I assume you're a big fan of Arcade Fire today.
Yes, and as people probably know, on Saturday Night Live with Mick Jagger, even wearing a red shirt, which is not clear if Mick Jagger was in support, but Arcade Fire wore the red square that's come to symbolize the student movement, which was, I think, give a nice boost, a nice artistic, international boost. To the student movement here.
Yeah, we wanted to make sure that came out because the Toronto Star didn't share that with its readers.
Yeah, not a surprise.
Eve Engler, boy, it's great talking to you. We envy you, but we got our red squares on. And it's a great book, Lester Pearson's Peacemaking, The Truth May Hurt. It's a great book. Thanks very much, Eve.
Thanks for having me.
See you. Bye-bye. Gee, I'd like to stay there, wouldn't you?
Well, it certainly sounds exciting. I have a website where you can actually see live streaming of the demonstration. And
sure.
if you like, I'll share it. It's from Concordia, and it's www.livestream.com/CUTV Montreal. And this is Concordia University's television live video and interviews from the streets of Montreal. So there's like right on the spot news, which again, of course, our national networks and newspapers can't give us from the demonstrations. So that's www.livestream.com/CUTV Montreal.
Yeah, it's very important that now people free themselves. Part of the whole concept of 1% 99 and is to understand that, for example, La Presse is owned by the Power Corporation, which is the owners of that are Demaray, and they employ people like John Ray, who, unlike his brother, thought, no, I'm going to go straight for the money, leave out the folly swaddles of politics. But the Power Corporation wanted Mr. Charest, and we have to remind our listeners of that fateful moment in Parliament when all parties, the Liberal Party and the Conservative Party and the NDP, said, oh, Jean Charest, they all stood up. Go to Quebec and become. He was a member. He had been in the cabinet of Mulroney. He was a conservative. He was a deputy to Kim Campbell, but they said somebody's got to do something about Quebec. So we're sending you. So that was And a little cabal put together by the parties, so-called federal parties, go and be the medicine. So he brought the story of the, what he calls a partnership of private public-private partnership,
which right.
is I think three P. It goes PPP on you, and that, he brought that to Quebec, and now he is reaping that. But don't worry, they have a little thing for him, and they will retire him to Wall Street or some such place. But it's going to be the people who do it. And I want to say too that I don't understand. Well, I do understand. Let me back up. I understand. Today's Star, for example, has a comment on the Cannes Film Festival. Now, one of the brilliant young directors, and he's a prodigy, this guy. He's 23, 24 years old, Javier Dolan. He is there, and he has a new film, and he's been a sensation at Cannes, which just puts Canada, Quebec, on a world stage. People are really appreciative of the talent. Now, he came to his press conference wearing a red square, and he's written about today, and that is not mentioned. And there was more than one reporter who wanted to fence with him about his politics, saying, what are you doing with that, wearing that? And according to my sources, he gave them the Italian salute. Our film reviewer didn't think we needed to know that. Oh, yes, we did. But that's why we need CIUT. That's why we need alternative radio. And that's why you have to dig and scratch and go find the truth yourself. Because the function of the mainstream press is not just to give you information, it's to hide information. So that's why Theodore Dreiser, the great novelist, said we don't need freedom of the press, we need freedom from it. He didn't mean he's against papers. What he meant was the daily paper is the daily agenda of the power corporation, of the banks, and they'll tell you what's important. And therefore, if you want to know what's important, you're going to have to go and do your homework. So this is a Taylor Report at CIUT 89.5 FM, and we're going to take a break, and we're going to come back, and we're going to talk to Steve Gowans. Oh, what do you know? We're back. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. You can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm, and you can check us out, taylor-report.com. I want to thank Eve Engler for talking to us from a crowd of more than 50 people, so he's a criminal, in Montreal. I understand there's a picture of a guy with a great sign walking down the street, and the sign says, I am number 49. And I understand also there's a website that where they say, tomorrow there will be a demonstration. It's going to be at 2 o'clock, and it's going to be thousands of people, and the slogans are going to be, no tuition and blah, blah, and we're against the the banks. And then it says, please do not attend this demonstration. So we are joined now by author Steve Gowans. Are you there, Steve?
Yes, I am. Hello, Phil.
Thanks for joining us. We were just speaking to Eve Engler in Montreal, and I would be remiss if I don't ask you, what do you make of what's going on with the student-led? They're turning into quite a social movement down there. Can you tell us what you think about that?
Sure. Well, first of all, I should say, not only should tuition fees not be increased, they should be eliminated altogether. And now some say cheap university education is no longer affordable, but that's nonsense. I mean, education was free through university in the socialist countries when they existed, and they weren't anywhere near as affluent as our own society is. So if they could provide free university educations, why can't we? Mm-hmm. And what's more, our GDP per capita is much higher than it was when students were paying considerably less to go to university. So, what's changed? Yeah. It's not affordability.
Mm-hmm. And what do you make of the Chomsky comment that it's, he says, actually, it's also a part of ideological control to put you in debt.
Part of ideological control?
In other words, by making you indebted, creating a student debt, it becomes a way to intimidate, prevent people from thinking and speaking their minds.
Well, that's true. I mean, it certainly makes you more pliable if you're burdened by debt. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I mean, this is just a part of, you know, conservative forces that have gone on the offensive in a kind of class war to unburden themselves of contributing to the larger society. Mm-hmm. And they're saying, we're not paying taxes. On the contrary, everyone else must pay taxes, which we'll benefit from in the form of subsidies for businesses and foreign aid, which is run largely as subsidies for businesses and defense spending and so on. So, I mean, how do you reverse the trend in climbing tuition fees? Well, the electoral arena isn't a particularly promising avenue because conservative forces have always wanted to push people off the streets into the electoral arena because that's where they enjoy an enormous advantage. And that's where popular forces are easily contained.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's in the streets where two things can happen. I mean, one is that governments eventually capitulate to popular demands.
Mm-hmm.
Or governments lose legitimacy and are swept away and replaced by something altogether more responsive to the majority. Now, I don't think the latter is going to happen, but certainly the former has a good possibility of happening.
Yeah. I wonder, do you think that what we're witnessing in Montreal and many other places, but boy, this has really been remarkable there, is that we're seeing a collision between the what they told us was the one and only model from now for now that history is over, the neoliberal, so I don't never understood the word, but neoliberal model, so it seems to be in a collision with the 99% movement.
Yes, and I mean, that's what they told us, that the neoliberal model was the only model, but...
And it was forever. Remember that? It's incredible to think of that, that that's the way they sold that.
Right. But there's a lot of evidence, not only what's happening in Quebec now, but elsewhere, that no one really accepted that. Even in international polls that have done, you look at international polls on people's political attitudes, you'll find that they are far from neoliberal, and they are decidedly social democratic.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's rejected that.
Now that you made this point that you know that we have a very affluent society, certainly the banks are doing okay, and yet they have this thing where they're going to jack up tuition wherever they can and say that only those who can pay can do anything. And when they're challenged, they don't want to listen to any challenges. And as a matter of fact, they become brutal, very dismissive. I wonder, do you think we can afford the rich anymore? I mean. Is it time to start thinking about that?
Oh, that's an interesting way to put it.
if it's my kid goes to school or there's no rich people, I think I live with that.
Well, sure. I mean,
and they say, okay, you be less rich and my kid goes to school. I'm ready for that.
Well, certainly the super rich have had kind of a parasitic relationship to the larger society. So.
Mm-hmm.
Could we no longer afford them? Well, could we no longer afford parasites, I think.
Exactly. By the way, I mean, the language is all opening up right across the board because of this movement, the Occupy movement, and this fake infatuation that our masters have with the spring of the Arabs and all that. They think all these things are wonderful there. But they don't think it's wonderful here. As a matter of fact, it's the same phenomenon. They say, get the billy clubs and start shooting.
Yes, here and in other places where the Arab Spring has erupted, Western powers would not like to see their allies overthrown, such as in Bahrain or Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
And where it, you know. In Bahrain, you had Saudi forces moving into Bahrain with tanks and violently cracking down on an uprising there. No one in the West and the United States seemed to be particularly concerned by that example of inhumanity.
Mm-hmm.
So they seem to be very selective in concern about violence.
Yeah, they may have the net effect of sort of internationalizing us when people look abroad and see these things and notice that the... who they have something in common with and who they don't. And I have one other esoteric question I want to ask you before we want to talk to you about NATO, but this phenomenon of saying you can't wear a mask. I've been charmed by this wonderful mask of the smiling figure from, was it Vendetta? I forget the name of the movie. It's a terrific mask. I haven't worn it, but I'd love to have one. But, you know, when they brag to us about when they tell us they need all new powers because of the war on terror, they get to go through our emails, listen to phone calls, monitor everything we write or who we meet with, and we have no right to know they're doing that. I mean, aren't they almost telling us we ought to put on masks?
Well, yes. And
Viva Vendetta, Carol tells me.
Yeah. No, that's right.
But they are making us. I mean, it is logical, right? If they say, well, I'm going to squirrel around and find out all about you. I mean, it seems to me it's almost a natural. What will come from that is people making themselves less accessible to these damn spies.
That's true. And obviously, I mean, this kind of legislation to prohibit the use of masks is simply a way of making it easier to contain popular forces. And it kind of reminds me of the song by Ewan McCall called Legal Illegal, where he says, he talks about what's criminal and what isn't, but to picket is legal, but to picket effectively, that is a crime. Well, likewise, to demonstrate effectively is a crime. And anything that allows you to demonstrate effectively has to be undermined in some way. And I mean, that's simply an example of undermining that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and now it's taking up this matter. There are demonstrations going on in Chicago, rather large ones, and the target is NATO. We haven't seen this phenomenon either for a long time. It's today, soldiers. Well, I guess yesterday, but throughout the weekend in Chicago, veterans who served in Iraq and served in Afghanistan, wearing their dungarees, have said, "I'm giving you this medal back." We want to get into what NATO is, but what do you make of that phenomena?
Well, no, I think the problem for NATO is that it lacks an explanation for its legitimate existence. What would make it legitimate in the eyes of the citizens of NATO countries? If it was a defensive organization, it might be seen as legitimate, but it's clearly not a defensive organization. I mean, at one point, people could be persuaded that it was defensive because the Soviet Union had been demonized and appeared to be large enough to pose a threat, and it was said that NATO was a bulwark against Soviet aggression.
Mm-hmm.
The Soviet Union was never a threat. It was Stalin's fervent wish to continue his wartime alliance with the United States and Britain. And indeed, this isn't widely known, but in 1954, the USSR asked to be able to join NATO. The request, not surprisingly, was rejected. And the Soviets were too weak militarily to take on the United States and simply sought peaceful coexistence to rebuild its war-shattered economy. But today, NATO powers together account for over 70% of the world's military expenditures. So if it's a defensive alliance, who is it defending against?
Mm-hmm.
Now, you might be able to make NATO look legitimate if it were seen to be an organization for conducting humanitarian missions, but many people find that hard to buy. So it appears to some that it has no purpose, but it really has no purpose that people are going to embrace as legitimate.
Uh-huh.
I think it's regarded as, correctly, as a military alliance that has no legitimate reason for existing. It does have a reason for existing, but it's not regarded as legitimate. And I think the reason for existing, it's simply a war machine. It's an alliance for conducting military operations against countries that are not satellites of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
They're too weak to defend themselves. And also for hemming in countries that are not satellites of the United States but are too strong to be directly attacked, like Russia, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, by the way, I want to tell people this is Steve Gowans, and it's gowans.wordpress.com. A lot of very brilliant articles, but particularly lately, there's one on the developments in Myanmar, and great comment on the Charles Taylor trial. Steve, I'm curious. They're using new language in East Europe, and there's something called the shield. Are you studying, kind of following? The Russians have said, rather startlingly, that they don't consider that a something they can just let pass. It's actually sort of crossing a red line. What is going on there with the so-called missile shield that NATO wants to push into Poland, I guess, in Ukraine, wherever?
Yeah, the missile shield, this follows the rejection by the Bush administration of the anti-ballistic missile treaty. And, of course, the problem with rejecting an anti-ballistic missile treaty and establishing a missile shield is that provides you with a first-strike capability. And the Russians are, legitimately concerned that what the United States is interested in doing is establishing the capability of striking Russia with nuclear weapons and then being able to defend itself against the retaliation. Mm. The U.S. says that it has no intention of doing that, and it's building a missile shield to protect itself and its allies from Iran and North Korea.
But didn't the Russians ask them to put that in writing?
Yeah, and this has been going on. So the Russians said, well, if that's the case, why don't we cooperate on this and we'll put it all in writing, and the Americans continually reject them. And, no, we can't do that.
You know, they look so much like a street hustler who approaches you with a couple of watches. And then you say, can I have a good look at the watch? He says, hey, don't bother me. I'm busy. I'll be back in a minute.
No, absolutely.
I mean, it's ugly.
Yes. No, and as I said, there are good reasons why the Russians are skeptical. And certainly if the tables were turned, the United States would be just as skeptical and just as vehemently opposed.
Yeah. Now, this is Steve Gowans, and Canada, of course, as part of NATO. We were speaking earlier to Eve Engler. He's written a book about Lester Pearson. Lester Pearson said one of his proudest accomplishments was building a NATO. And I think the New Democratic Party, somewhere in the bowels of its program, said that once that they were going to quit NATO. And indeed, by the way, there are politicians now, today, 2012, who are talking about it in Greece and France, who is major. But I get the impression that nobody quits. Well, it wouldn't be so simple, would it?
No. France had quit at one point, but rejoined in, I think it was 2009.
But that's Charles de Gaulle.
Yes. And then Sarkozy brought them back.
Mm-hmm. But it's George Washington, you had that great line, don't form any entangling alliances, but this is a pretty tangled up alliance group. It just strikes me that when we talk about it, when we ought to be talking about it, why is Canada in NATO? But you would also have to say you need to talk about what kind of a power you are in relation to other powers, because you could be stamped on.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and as I was saying, one of the purposes of NATO is to expand the group of countries that are satellites of the United States. I think it's Michael Parente who says that the United States defines countries in two ways. You're either a satellite or you're an enemy, and there's nothing in between. And so if you're not a satellite, you need to become one, and often becoming one means being incorporated into NATO. I should point out, though, that Russia's offered on many occasions to become a part of NATO, and NATO or the United States is not interested, mm-hmm. which may make clear what one of the purposes of NATO is.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you, Steve, the historians haven't really helped us out much with this NATO story, have they? Because NATO, actually, I think it's part of our common knowledge, which is always wrong, that as you pointed out, NATO was thought of as a bulwark against the Soviet Union following World War II. There was the Warsaw Pact, the Soviet grouping, wasn't formed until after NATO. And as you point out, also, the Soviets weren't allowed to join. But we've got our the sequence has always been misrepresented to us, hasn't it? There was a lie to begin with.
Yes, and I mean, that's very interesting when you look at the timeline. And the way I look at the timeline, I go back to 1936, which is when the Anti-Comintern Pact was established by Japan and Germany. And it was directed at the Soviet Union, which the signatories agreed constituted a threat to the civilized world, as they put it.
That was Hitler's protecting the civilized world.
Right, and then 1949 comes along, NATO's established ostensibly to deter the threat posed by the Soviet Union to the free world. Mm-hmm. So now it has the same ostensible mission. Now, the Anti-Comintern Pact, which is supposed to be defensive, obviously wasn't, because those countries then attacked the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. NATO ostensibly is defensive, but then in 1954, again, the Soviet Union offers to join NATO, and its offer is rejected. In 1955, West Germany is brought into NATO. Now, Germany was supposed to be disarmed. Demilitarized.
Demilitarized, yes, nice word.
But it's rearmed and remilitarized and brought into NATO. This is on May 9th, 1955. And one of the reasons why is because the Bundeswehr was the largest army in Europe. And so if you're going to make NATO into kind of an effective military alliance for pressuring the Soviet Union, then you need West Germany in it. Mm-hmm. That's May 9th. May 14th, the Warsaw Pact is established. So the Warsaw Pact is established as a reaction to...
rearming Germany.
Yes, which is breaking the agreements that the United States and Britain had with the Soviet Union following the end of the Second World War.
Yeah, in which all of humanity said, that's a real good idea. We had all been bled hideously by that war.
Mm-hmm.
And yet that guy with the cigar and his other cons rearmed them.
Yes. And you can imagine how the Soviet Union's reacting to a rearmed, remilitarized West Germany. I mean, a Germany that has invaded Russia on two occasions in the 20th century and caused outstanding, devastating damage to the country and tens of millions of people dead. Mm-hmm. Obviously, they're going to be sensitive to a rearmed and remilitarized West Germany, but one now that was under the control of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Which obviously was had, you know, little fondness for the Soviet Union.
Yeah. You know, I recall, I just recently read, I recall reading recently, Arthur Schlesinger's journals from being in the Kennedy administration. He was at a meeting once where leaders were talking, and Kennedy said, you know, our problem is, one of my problems is that our people have never been bombed. He said, you have a different experience. You know, we didn't go through these. The World War One and Two never damaged any American homes. Seems to be part of the thing. I want to ask, this is Steve Gowans, gowans.wordpress.com. We had an expression. It went off the screen very fast. It was called the peace dividend. When we had Gorbachev said, okay, I give up. I want to be like you. And they gave him a job with Pizza Hut, and then. But where's our damn peace dividend? And how did NATO say we're going to keep going?
Well, I mean, that event is very interesting in many respects. I mean, I should mention too that when the Germanies were unified. And East Germany, that was then going to be brought into NATO, it said that, or Gorbachev claims that the United States made a commitment not to expand NATO eastward toward the Soviet borders. And since then, I mean, that's exactly what's happened. Mm-hmm. Now we have, I mean, all the East European members of the Warsaw Pact are now members of NATO. The three former, I mean, Baltic republics of the Soviet Union are members of NATO. I think Ukraine and Georgia are scheduled to become members of NATO, so that expansion toward Russia certainly happened.
Mm-hmm.
And the peace dividend, well, I mean, the other interesting thing then is if NATO was claimed to be a defensive alliance, a bulwark against the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union dissolves and NATO continues to exist, then obviously it was never a defensive alliance against the Soviet Union. If it continues to expand and push its way toward Russia, then maybe it's a way, among other things. I mean, one of its purpose, among many other purposes, is to hem in and contain Russia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I have to say, by the way, that interests. We had Rick Rozoff on recently. I'm sure you appreciate his work. He's in Chicago right now. This question, you know, it didn't. It turns out that with the Russians, it didn't matter whether they were communists or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think you have to look ultimately at, you know, the goals of U.S. foreign policy. And I think the goals of U.S. foreign policy are to open all markets to U.S. enterprises and to prevent any country from limiting the profit-making activities of U.S. corporations or banks and investors. So it doesn't matter if it's the country's communist or it's a capitalist country that's economically nationalist and is looking out for its own enterprises. The United States doesn't care. All it cares about is, do I have access to their markets, and can I make money in those markets?
Yeah, I guess in psychological terms, they're a sociopath.
Yes.
Yeah. hey, Steve, it's great talking to you. Great, you have a wonderful website, gowans.wordpress.com. You got so many great articles. We look forward to talking to you sometime soon.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Steve Gowans, thank you. Bye-bye. That was Steve Gowans, and like I said, gowans.wordpress.com. That's the story on the NATO phenomenon. And good for those folks in Chicago who finally, we've been waiting to see this, these former soldiers and ordinary Americans coming in the streets and saying, we don't want our country to be an aggressive power anymore. By the way, there's one candidate running in California, a Democrat, and he says his favorite bumper sticker that he has actually seen on the highways says red, white, and blue. These colors don't run the world. Phil, you have an announcement.
Right. First of all, Sid Ryan, the president of the Ontario Federation of Labor, will be journeying to Montreal tomorrow to participate in the demonstrations and to show the solidarity of Ontario labor and the Ontario labor movement with Quebec. Wow. Boy, this is going to upset those big boys. I'm sure that the Globe and Mail will have something to say about that.
Yes.
And a large number of student leaders in Ontario have written an open letter to the Canadian Federation of Students saying that we should be preparing now for the fall to spread the student strike to Ontario. Yeah. So there's a lot of ferment. The infection is spreading, I think, is how the our betters would view it, and good for that.
I agree with you. Although I would say I'd like to send a telegram to them and say thank you very much. That's a great statement. However, October is October, and May is May. And, you know, we have to move quickly, I think, because, you know, people are being beaten up. They're having their rights ripped out of their hands. And the time to speak then is then, the moment. We need the maximum. I want to just echo something I said earlier. This is a Victoria Day, so-called, here. It is Patriots Day in Quebec by law. It's Patriots Day. Now, they are commemorating the struggle of 1837, the rebellion, which won, ultimately led to with so-called responsible government, that is, you know, elect your own leaders, a form of government. And if we had a Patriots Day in Toronto, it would be considered unpatriotic because we wouldn't be supporting Victoria, under whose reign the Patriots were hanged. So we ought to be – that's something to meditate about. And one last thing on the our problems with sound, that is, the sound of – thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people demonstrating in Quebec. And there's a kind of, we're not getting the impact of that. And there's an analogy with warfare. They say during battles, in wars, there are sometimes situations where because of wind and topography, an army can be 1 mile from another army and not hear a sound because there's some kind of obstruction. We've got to make sure we eliminate the obstruction between ourselves and Montreal and Quebec. Anyway, this is, I want to thank Carol, Phil Conlon, Stan Babbitt, and this is Phil Taylor. Write to us, taylor@ciut.fm, and check us out, taylor-report.com. And thanks to Eve Engler again and Steve Gowan. So see you next week.